Well, our time has come to start, and it is my privilege to welcome all of you in the live audience in front of me and the audience listening by teleclass. Welcome you to the teleclass, Reducing Spread of Pathogens by Environmental Surfaces in Healthcare, Have We Advanced in the Last 10 Years? And it is a distinct privilege indeed to be able to introduce Professor Syed Sattar of the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa. Professor Sattar is a man who stands out in his field. He is founder and director of his highly distinguished center, known commonly as CREM. He has some 300 articles and book chapters to his credit. He has given invited lectures at just about every English language infection control conference around the world. And he has a very long list of distinguished awards. His CV runs to 57 pages, and I note that he stopped adding to it 2 or 3 years ago, so it would be much longer still, I'm sure. He's widely lauded as a leader in his field. He has been an inspiration and a mentor to many, myself included. His students have spread around the globe and are among the shining lights in business, government, and academia. Today we are broadcasting this lecture live from the University of Ottawa because exactly 10 years ago today, this man gave the very first lecture in what would ultimately become known as the Teleclass Education Lecture Series. It's a program that I've been honored to co-found and been involved with for all this time. And in fact, I usually take the credit for the Teleclass Education Lecture Series. However, Professor Sattar works quietly in the background, and it should be said that he is, in fact, essential to the success of this program. He is truly a great man, and he's been a great friend. And I thank you very much for that. I'd also like to acknowledge the sponsors of this teleclass, Diversey and Virox. These two companies especially have been with the teleclass education program from the very start. And I think it wouldn't exist if not for the support of these two companies among our greater group of sponsors. But these guys have been very generous to us, and thank you very much to you folk. From the University of Ottawa, to present Reducing the Spread of Pathogens by Environmental Surfaces in Healthcare, Have We Advanced in the Last 10 Years? I give you Professor Syed Sattar. Dr. Sattar.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you, everybody, for coming to this lecture this afternoon. It is indeed a pleasure to be addressing the audience at the 10th anniversary of the teleclass. Paul gives me more credit than I deserve, but of course I never complain about it. And I guess the poster that he put together announcing this event has a picture of mine which is perhaps at least a decade old. And I think it's his way of showing you as to how I have progressed or deteriorated myself in the past decade. And I like to mention that even though I don't work at a hospital, but I have the unique opportunity of being able to interact with manufacturers, regulators, standard-setting organizations, and, of course, end users, which gives me a truly unique perspective on the topic at hand. Next slide, please. I'd like to again thank Paul and Jason Tetreault at my center, and of course a lot of my staff and students who work in the background to be able to do the things that I'm always proud to go around the world to talk about. So those people do deserve a great deal of credit for what I'm going to be talking about. I will not crowd up the presentation with a lot of references to individual studies, which I have abstracted for this particular presentation, but I can tell you that there will be a fairly extensive reading list for what I'm referring to in my presentation available at the Weber Training website for you to access and utilize as you please. Next slide, please. It's important that I disclose my association with the private sector and also other organizations. For over three decades now, I've been interacting with dozens of large and small companies with the basic intention of promoting better assessment and marketing of safer and more effective microbicides. As an academic, I also enjoy the luxury of picking and choosing the right company and formulations to work on. I'm happy to say that such interactions have indeed led to substantial improvements in the marketing and label claims of environmental surface disinfectants in particular. Next slide. While the topic at hand is truly vast and varied, the past decade has seen a definite change in it for the better. I also firmly believe that we have reached that proverbial tipping point here, and further improvements are anticipated with time. However, there is a potential downside to the situation. The upsurge in interest in infection prevention and control has spawned much commercial interest, with the good and the ugly that inevitably come with any marketing opportunity. My objective here is to give you a critical perspective on where we are at and where we may be going. Please note that any mention of specific products or services will be for information purposes only, and it would not constitute any endorsement by me or by my center. I will also make some predictions along the way, knowing that I most likely won't be around for the next decade to defend them. Next slide, please. Much has been written on the impact of healthcare-associated infections, or HAI, as they are called in short, in the United States and Canada. Each year, over 2 million cases of HAI cause nearly 100,000 fatalities in the U.S. and cost over $30 billion in healthcare spending. Comparable numbers for Canada are over 200,000 cases and up to 12,000 fatalities. These figures make HAI the fourth largest killer in Canada. The HAI-related fatalities outnumber those from AIDS, breast cancer, and traffic accidents combined. Over 30 to 40% of HAI are considered preventable. Why are we not doing enough to prevent the preventable? This question is being raised at all levels, and a strong consensus is now building for action. We will examine how the disinfection of environmental surfaces could contribute towards meeting such an objective. Next slide, please. As you will see soon, many ineffective and potentially harmful chemicals are still in common use as microbicides. Training, monitoring, and recognition of housekeeping or housekeepers remain poor. Updating a product registration process is not only slow, but also based on flawed test method. Labels on marketed disinfectants remain difficult to read understanding them with a vital piece of information are often missing from such labels. Wiping is common in disinfection of environmental surfaces, but its contribution rarely assessed in making claim. I will expand on this particular aspect a little later on. The term green is being used with gay abandon for marketing purposes and without sufficient scrutiny. In my opinion, plant extracts, essential oils, and household chemicals such as baking powder and vinegar may be green, but they simply do not have the spectrum and speed of activity for use as disinfectants in healthcare settings. Recent studies have also found the regular use of certain plant-based materials to mimic hormones and thus interfere with body's growth and development. For example, exposure to lavender and tea tree oil has been linked to prepubertal gynecomastia, which is the enlargement of breasts in young boys. This may sound heretical, but I believe that a combination of the above-listed factors may well be inadvertently spreading HAI instead of preventing them by the routine disinfection of environmental surfaces. I will soon illustrate this point further with some examples. Obviously, this situation must change soon if we are to properly combat HAI. Next slide, please. This pie chart based on the use of disinfectants in the United States in institutional industrial settings is a goldmine of information. It has several take-home messages. Among these are that there are over 5,000 registered disinfectants in the U.S. Over 60% of these are for use against human pathogens. So the use of disinfectants in the United States and Canada, the vast majority of those are used for combating healthcare-associated infections and human pathogens in general. The registered product contain about 275 different actives, which are microbicidal chemicals. Luckily, just 14 of these are found in 95% of the marketed disinfectants. Annual sales of disinfectants are already in billions of dollars, and the market is increasing rapidly. Many multinationals are actively investing in this area in anticipation of reaping considerable profits. The past decade has seen a reduction in the use of disinfectant chemicals such as phenolics and aldehydes and pine oil. My prediction is that there will soon be further changes in the relative proportions of the actives, with an increase in the slice of the pie representing oxidizers, as you will see that later on as well. There are several reasons for the increasing popularity of oxidizing chemicals and disinfectants. They can be fast-acting, broad-spectrum, and rapidly break down into relatively innocuous byproducts. However, their potential for corrosion remains a challenge in certain settings. Next slide, please. The training and monitoring of housekeeping staff is often woefully inadequate. Yet, they are expected to work under potentially hazardous conditions, often using unsuitable products and procedures. This is akin to having ill-trained and ill-equipped frontline soldiers in a major battle. The Canadian Union of Public Health Employees, CUPE, is now actively publicizing the plight of housekeepers in healthcare settings, and I consider this as a grassroots movement, which hopefully will result in a positive impact very soon. Here is a recent example of how a housekeeper in a U.S. hospital was contaminating environmental surfaces with potentially harmful bacteria in patient rooms during the process of disinfecting them. We conducted some of the testing for the study together with Dr. John Boyce of a particular hospital in the New England states in the United States. The key messages from the study are that an environmental audit noted a huge increase in the numbers of bacteria on disinfected surfaces. The contamination was traced to a used dilution of a quaternary ammonium-based product stored unused for weeks in a bucket. The disinfectant contains over 100,000 colony-forming units per ml of three types of potentially harmful bacterial species, including two strains of Serratia marcescens. Work at CREM found at least one of the three isolates to be 100-fold more resistant to that disinfectant compared to a standard strain of the same species. The isolate was also shown to be highly resistant to six commonly used antibiotics. Such pathogens can be particularly devastating in wards housing the immunocompromised. Next slide, please. Here is another glaring example of how housekeepers are not doing their job properly. This histogram is based on some data from a healthcare facility in the United States. The bars on the left show the levels of contamination with a vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, or VRE, on high-touch surfaces in several patient wards. Even after decontamination by the housekeeping staff, using 10% bleach, a strong disinfectant, many of the surfaces still showed high levels of VRE contamination. The contamination could be brought to undetectable levels when the same surfaces were wiped by the research team. This clearly tells me that the routine decontamination of high-touch surfaces around patients is often no more than a ritual and potentially counterproductive, in addition to being a total waste of time and resources. Next slide, please. Is anything being done to improve the training of housekeeping staff and also to better monitor their performance? Fortunately, yes. While devices based on ATP measurements have been around for a while, Dr. Phil Carling of Boston has recently invented a simple, high-tech and a highly effective device for the purpose. The kit shown here is now commercially available. Dabs of a clear solution in plastic tubes can be placed on the surface to be disinfected. The degree of fluorescence revealed using a black light pen is inversely proportional to the level of decontamination by wiping with a disinfectant. The kits are now being used in many hospitals and a wide variety of other settings to improve environmental surface decontamination. I know that several Canadian hospitals are among the institutions participating in a major study on the device as a training tool for housekeepers. Next slide. As far as I'm concerned, a government registration number, often referred to as a DIN or drug identification number, on a disinfectant has a limited value. This is because the registration process itself is based on outdated requirements and flawed testing, thus making it another weak link in the fight against HAI. In general, neither materials managers in healthcare settings nor infection preventionists have enough training or acumen to exercise judgment here. They simply take the label at its face value, and unfortunately, environmental surface disinfectants are often selected based on price alone or because they come as a part of the bundle from a given manufacturer. A review of this issue is urgently needed. Next slide. This is among my main beefs when it comes to environmental surface disinfectants. I highlight it every chance I get. The contact time on the labels of such products is often just too long for field use. This is especially true when the target surface is being wiped with a disinfectant applicator of some kind. In such cases, which is in fact represents the vast majority of scenarios for disinfecting hard non-porous environmental surfaces, the contact time is frequently much less than 1 minute, probably no more than a few seconds. Further, product labels are often silent on the very crucial issue of the ratio between disinfectant volume and the surface area to be disinfected. We have shown that disinfectant volumes deposited during the wiping of surfaces from pre-soaked applicators amount to no more than a fraction of a microliter per square centimeter. This is a far cry from how one conducts the testing of disinfectants for label claims. While marketed products are sold primarily for use on pre-clean surfaces, their labels rarely give clear directions for such pre-cleaning. In addition, labels on disinfectant products are jam-packed with long lists of totally irrelevant microorganisms. Labels of disinfectants often call themselves broad spectrum, meaning that they are active against gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. While that meaning of the term has much relevance for antibiotics, for any environmental surface disinfectant, it must mean activity against other classes of pathogens such as viruses and fungi as well as bacteria. Next slide, please. Frankly, for environmental surface disinfectants, I fail to see the need for claims against pathogens such as HIV, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, specific claims even against Mycobacterium tuberculosis are hard to justify for environmental surface disinfection. This practice perpetuates the misconception based on the fear factor. We have been actively lobbying against this practice, and I'm hopeful that this situation will change for the better soon. Next slide, please. Here is a very good example of how things have improved in the past decade. Some 10 years ago, dozens of environmental surface disinfectants made label claims against Clostridium difficile, but based on their activity against the vegetative cells of the pathogen. This is noteworthy here. As many of you know, it is the spore form which is not only highly stable in the environment, but also responsible for the spread of the infection in healthcare settings. Products tested using the vegetative form most likely would not work against the spores. In fact, the use of such formulations could easily lead to the spread of the spores over a wider area of the surfaces being disinfected. The main reason given for those inappropriate label claims was the difficulty in obtaining viable spores of high enough titer to conduct the testing. We have not only started a campaign to change the regulations, but also successfully developed a synthetic liquid medium to produce high titers of viable spores of standard as well as clinical strains of C. difficile. Soon, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency asked for a voluntary recall of label claims against C. difficile and also issued a new guidance document requiring testing against the spores for any future label claims. However, the current guidance does not require the use of an added soil load in testing, thus potentially undermining the label claims again. AOAC International, a highly respected standard-setting organization, now has a panel of experts reviewing the testing requirements against C. difficile and may recommend the addition of soil load for testing and label claims in the near future. In the meanwhile, there are several registered products on the market based on testing against the spore, a definite improvement in the situation in the past decade. Next slide, please. Well, what would one expect for the next decade? If the momentum generated during the past decade is to continue, we must, number one, actively discourage testing and label claims against the bug of the month. This current practice is not science-based and uses the fear factor for commercial gains. Number two, incorporate suitable surrogate in realistic tests. There is an urgent need to incorporate better test protocols for regulatory purposes. This could go a long way in making the registration process and label claims a lot more meaningful for the end user. Number three, better wipe testing protocol must be developed and standardized so that environmental surface disinfectants can be marketed with claims incorporating testing with wiping action. Number four, as mentioned before, we are still using too many unsafe and ineffective products. A concerted effort is needed to develop and promote the use of safer and better microbicides. Number five, currently, innovation is stifled due to dated testing requirements and the need to comply with vastly different regulations even within the same region. This discourages even larger companies from investing in R&D due to the inordinate expense for product development. Global harmonization of testing and registration requirements will go a long way to correct the situation. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, is now working towards such an objective, and I'm happy to say that our work is at the forefront of that initiative. Number six, we must soon address the deficiencies in the training and monitoring of housekeeping staff. They must also be better recognized for the crucial role they play in our fight against HAI. Without this, all else is likely to be futile. Next slide, please. Even though wiping is an integral part of decontaminating environmental surfaces, the housekeeping staff are insufficiently trained in and monitored for this important function. Wiping is often cursory and may actually spread contamination. The testing of disinfectants for their microbicidal activity often does not account for the demand the applicator has on the disinfectant that is being used. As mentioned before, the contact time during wiping is no more than a few seconds. The disinfectant volume placed on the wiped surface may be less than 1 microliter per square centimeter, as I have already mentioned. No suitable and standardized method to test the role of wiping is available. Attempts are now underway to address this gap. The BEED lab of the United States Environmental Protection Agency has recently developed a quantitative method for testing wipes. Dr. Jean-Yves Maillard of the Welsh School of Pharmacy has published a method for this purpose. We at CREM have also developed a new device called the Wiperator to assess the role of wiping action under well-controlled and field-relevant conditions. Next slide, please. Thus far, I focused on the use of liquid disinfectants for decontaminating environmental surfaces. This figure shows other means for doing the same. I will discuss them in some detail. Next slide, please. Some of the technologies, some of the techniques in the previous figure are not new but have been adapted from work with infectious biothreat agents. Good examples here are gases, mists, and foam. Several others are in early stages of development. Some of them are indeed chemical-free. Next slide, please. Gases, mists, and foams include, as I just mentioned, some well-established as well as newer technologies. For example, the use of vaporized hydrogen peroxide and chlorine dioxide gas came to prominence during the anthrax episode of October 2001 when they were used to decontaminate several large buildings in the U.S. The Canadian Aqueous System for Chemical Biological Agent Decontamination, or CASCAD, foam was developed by the military to deal with infectious agents again, but is now available for civilian use. It is based on sodium dichloroisocyanurate. Even though formaldehyde has been around for a while, its use is now restricted due to concerns with carcinogenicity and potential for damage to the environment. Peracetic acid is now gaining greater acceptance both as a liquid and also as a vapor or mist. The use of ethanol mist has been reported recently, but there are obvious concerns with its flammability and also its lack of activity against bacterial spores. The use of most gases, mists, and foams requires expensive equipment and much training, along with downtimes of about 2 hours to 24 hours for each application. Rooms to be decontaminated must be unoccupied and sealed. There is also potential for corrosion and damage to sensitive items. Next slide, please. The use of ozone as a disinfecting gas has been attempted before, but there are at least 2 new recent studies with slightly different approaches to the same theme. In one, pure ozone at about 25 parts per million has been used along with a quenching gas for disinfecting rooms. It reports roughly a 3-log drop in vegetative bacteria and Clostridium difficile spores on agar plates and hard environmental surfaces. I can understand the possible activity on hard surfaces, but the claim that it also worked on the target bacteria growing on agar plates is somewhat puzzling. In that scenario, one would expect an immediate neutralization or breakdown of the highly reactive and unstable ozone. So I'm not sure how they came up with those particular set of claims. The second study, done by my friend Dr. Zoutman at Queen's University, used much higher levels of ozone, nearly 80 parts per million, along with a vapor of hydrogen peroxide for room decontamination. This is a new approach, and it showed some promising results. It reported a million-fold reduction in the viability of vegetative bacteria and bacterial spores on metal discs in 30 to 90 minutes, depending on the room size where the decontamination was being carried out. While ozone can be a fast-acting and broad-spectrum oxidizer, it can be generated on site. It can be corrosive and explosive, requiring great care in its use. Next slide, please. Triclosan has been used for some time now for doping plastics to make items such as countertops. However, its microbicidal activity is slow and limited, and the use of triclosan is causing or is potentially able to cause some problems of human toxicity and also give rise to cross-resistance to antibiotics. Also, its activity is abrogated in the presence of body fluids. These factors together are leading to a drastic restriction in its use, particularly in certain European countries. Next slide, please. Quaternary ammonium and silver-based polymers are often used for the purpose of coating hard environmental surfaces with claims for residual or sustained activity. Their use also claims to cut down on the frequency of environmental surface disinfection. However, there are no standards and scientifically sound methods to verify such claims. The widespread use of such technologies poses a high risk of generation of microbicide-resistant microorganisms. The generally narrow spectrum of their microbicidal activity also remains a concern. Next slide. Recently, the EPA has granted some 300 alloys of copper registration as the only self-sanitizing surface. They claim broad-spectrum microbicidal action by contact killing and a 60% reduction in bacterial load has been shown as compared to other surfaces such as stainless steel. It is also claimed that since contact killing chews up microbial genomes, there is a much lower risk of generation of copper resistance. Field trials are now underway in hospitals in the UK and in the US where special areas have been built with copper surfaces or alloys of copper, and that field trials are underway to see if their use will impact on reducing the frequency of hospital-acquired or healthcare-acquired infections. Next slide. Among the newer approaches to decontaminate environmental surfaces is that of on-command technologies. The microbial action on them can be activated by electrical, magnetic, or ultrasound stimulation. For example, the pores on microbicide-impregnated ferrogels can open or close through magnetic forces or triggered to open or close through magnetic forces. There are also on-demand surfaces which exert microbicidal action when stimulated by the metabolic activity of microbial activity. At the moment, such an approach is restricted to medical devices such as catheters to prevent the development of biofilms on them. The use of microbial growth as triggers is basically unsafe in most settings and potentially unsuitable for environmental surface decontamination. Surfaces can be photosensitized by coating them with certain non-toxic dyes such as Rose Bengal to make them microbicidal in the presence of UV or visible light. This application may be used for treating food contact surfaces in particular. Next slide. Upconverting visible light into rays of ultraviolet C is an intriguing approach. Phosphors or luminescent activators can be baked onto materials such as glass coupons to make them microbicidal in the presence of ordinary light. Limited testing with Bacillus subtilis spores showed roughly a 90% reduction in the spore viability over 10 days. Obviously, this is just a very preliminary proof of concept and needs further experimentation with perhaps less resistant organisms. Next slide, please. While the use of UV light for decontamination of environmental surfaces has been around for decades, more recent advances in the UV lamp technology have given it a new life. Cheaper, longer-lasting, and more powerful UV lamps are now readily available for use in disinfecting environmental surfaces. One recent example is based on a device which can be used to disinfect hospital wards. The device has sensors which feed back on the UV dosage delivered for automatic shutoff. Here are the advantages of such an approach. Decontamination of exposed and shadowed areas may be possible. Remote operation and dosage selection is available. It represents a chemical-free and broad-spectrum process. No sealing of room and no special training of staff are needed. The process is faster, only 15 to 45 minutes for each cycle, and less expensive than using gas and mist-based approaches. There are, however, certain negatives as well. Exposure to UV light can cause mutations in microorganisms. The room to be treated must be evacuated. There is poor penetration of porous materials, and repeated UV exposure may be damaging to many articles. Next slide, please. Diodes have been designed to deliver high-intensity blue light with a wavelength of 405 nanometers. It claims to be bactericidal but safe for humans. The device does not need any photosensitizers and is meant for continuous operation and without the need for vacating the room. Thus far, it reports a modest 60 to 90% reduction in the levels of MRSA in burn units. Questions remain on the long-term safety and usefulness of this approach. For example, does it cause mutations in bacteria? Does it work against other types of nosocomial pathogens? Does it work on shaded areas? Does it work on porous materials such as linen? Next slide, please. Here is another example of an age-old technology finding new uses. Steam can be a chemical-free means of degreasing and decontamination of horizontal and vertical surfaces. In this study, discs of plastic and metal with dried inocula of MRSA and VRE were exposed for 5 seconds to steam from a portable device. This study was also conducted by Dr. Zutman's group at Queen's University in Kingston. It led to a million-fold reduction in both organisms. Such steam can be broad-spectrum, except against bacterial spores. Materials compatibility remains a concern. Also, its application to decontamination of large areas is still to be explored. Next slide, please. As mentioned before, there is such a buzz these days about green products and technologies. I believe that much is being sold under the guise of green, especially for environmental surface disinfection. In 1998, Anastas and Warner introduced some 12 principles for green chemistry. The following four relate directly to disinfectants in general. Number one, design safer chemicals and products that are fully effective with little or no toxicity. This is worth noting. Use safer solvents and reaction conditions. design chemicals and products to degrade after use so that they do not accumulate in the environment. Worth noting again, minimize potential for accidents such as explosions, fires, and releases into the environment. The first and the third item in the list are particularly worthy of note. I hope materials managers and infection preventionists will note these factors in deciphering any claims for green. Next slide, please. The past decade has seen much improvements with regards to testing standards and guidelines for product registration. Newer and better standards and guidelines are also on their way. For example, ASTM International and AOC International, two major standard-setting organizations, will soon introduce much-improved protocols for testing environmental surface disinfectants, and we at CREM are quite active in this particular endeavor. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is in the final stages of approving four harmonized quantitative carrier tests for hard surface disinfectants. Their meeting for the final decision is to occur in September this year. Health Canada issued a new guidance document in 2007. EPA is continually upgrading its regulations. EPA's recently introduced document called Design for the Environment has already set newer and more stringent criteria on the selection and use of disinfectants, among other things. Next slide, please. In closing, one should note that much progress has been made in the past decade, but a lot still remains to be done. It is quite encouraging to see a much greater appreciation of the potential of environmental surfaces in the spread of HAI. I understand that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now contemplating starting its own program for testing microbicidal chemicals. We need much greater emphasis on the development and use of better and safer, fast-acting and safer microbicides. We also must develop better ways to test new technologies before adopting them to avoid costly mistakes of the past. There is an urgent need to make product labels and claims on them more user-friendly and scientifically valid. Wipe test protocols must be developed and data based on them incorporated in label claims. And finally, we must train housekeepers better, monitor their performance more effectively, and also recognize their crucial role in our fight against HIV. I thank you.
Professor Sitar, thank you very much. Well done. We have time for some questions from the audience. Are there questions from anybody in the live audience here? Tom.
One question. They talk mostly about non-porous.
Yes.
We work in an environment that is mostly porous.
Yes.
Are there differences as far as quantity or quality?
Yeah. The question is that my talk focused on non-porous environmental surfaces. Is there a difference between those and porous surfaces, which are encountered in many settings for infection prevention and control? Indeed, there are several basic differences. Porous materials absorb pathogens much better than non-porous materials, meaning that a lot of the contamination can go deeper into the nooks and crannies of the porous material and is not as readily available for transfer. This is based on our own method, and we have actually published papers on that particular aspect. The other thing is that many porous materials, during their manufacture, have certain biocidal chemicals built into them that can be deleterious to a number of pathogens. So the load or the viability of a pathogen on a porous material is likely to go down faster than that on a non-porous material. The third factor is that when you apply a disinfectant onto a porous surface, you have to account for the demand that the basic material itself exerts on the disinfectant, because there is a lot of neutralization or absorption that goes on, leaving much less available for decontamination. So we normally don't recommend that liquid chemicals be used for decontamination of porous materials.
I've been noticing lately that there's been a pattern of different claims with a lot of new disinfectants coming out, especially quaternary ammonium-based compounds and maybe weak sodium hypochlorite solutions, where they're having claims against non-envelope viruses and noroviruses, which would have been something that would have never been heard of in the past. Can you comment on why we're seeing some of that lately?
The question is that recently, products based on quaternary ammonium or even weaker solutions of bleach are claiming activity against non-porous or non-enveloped viruses such as noroviruses. How realistic that is? That's an extremely important issue, Christian. Part of the reason is that the testing for label claims, the test protocol that are used for label claims, are seriously flawed. A lot of the testing that is done to generate such label claims for government registration are based on ASTM method numbered E1053. If you look at the way that method is used, it is heavily in favor of the product that is being tested. And we have been complaining about it because at some stage in the conduct of that test protocol, you actually change the carrier test into a suspension test, which in fact enhances the prospect of inactivation of even non-enveloped viruses such as noroviruses. So if you take the same product and test it against a more scientifically well-designed and rigorous method, those same products will not pass. And this is something that we do on a more or less regular basis. So again, I'm hoping that once the OECD methods are accepted for use, this situation probably will not arise. Yes?
We're starting to now see resistance to disinfectants and essentially microbial static chemicals like the triclosan to some extent. We're seeing the QAC gene now in some places like Brazil, where it's about 80% of all the MRSAs. Some of the top clinicians in Canada are now showing that the QAC is here in Toronto, we're in Ottawa. What do you say about the fact that, maybe all of this is actually doing exactly what we had done with antibiotics, and soon we're going to have microbicidal sequestration?
Yes, the question is with regards to the developing resistance in microorganisms against common chemical disinfectants such as quaternary ammonium-based compounds. And this is a very valid concern because I think that we are using too many weak or ineffective products improperly. And that is the issue. Now, the example that I gave of that study that we conducted with Dr. John Boyce, if you were to take that diluted product, which in fact was a quaternary ammonium-based formulation, tested it freshly made, it would meet the label claims. But if it was sitting around for a month, with all these bacteria growing, there was in fact a deterioration in the concentration where it simply failed to be bactericidal, actually allowing for the growth of resistant organisms to occur, not just one but three different kinds of bacteria. So this is a recipe for disaster. So this is why if you go to the criteria for green chemical that I just listed, it says that ideally, a disinfectant should do its job where it's needed and simply break down into innocuous byproducts. So therefore, the chances of accumulation or reaching levels which are sublethal to the bacteria simply does not arise. And I think this is an extremely important consideration, and we really must incorporate that in any future use of disinfectants.
We won't be able to take questions from our teleclass audience, unfortunately. But I would like to, I do have some thanks to give. Now, on my wall in my office for the last 3,650 days, I have had the only remaining poster of the original teleclass that Professor Sitar gave, and I look at it almost every weekday. Professor Sitar, as my thanks from me, I'd like you to have this for your wall.
Thank you very much. I'll cherish it. Thank you very much. This is great.
Now, from your audience, last September, I was given the opportunity to visit South Africa. And one group in Cape Town who had made great use of your teleclass program gave me a hand-carved water buffalo, I think this is. I'm sure they told me, but and they gave it to me as part of their thanks, and I'd like to pass this along to you on behalf of them their thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. This is great.
Now, I have also to thank all of the faculty that have joined us in the last 10 years. There have been many of them, and they are truly the best in the world. They've done a fabulous job, and I've been very grateful to them. I want to thank all of our sponsors, two of our sponsors here today, Diversey and Virox. These guys have, as I said earlier, they've been with us from the start. In fact, the entire second and third season of Teleclass Education was sponsored by Diversey. They weren't known as Diversey then, but same company. And if it wasn't for them, I think we might not have been able to financially manage it. This program is run entirely by volunteers, including Sitar and myself. We take no pay for this. And there's groups of volunteers all around the world, in Europe and in Asia and in the South Pacific, that make this happen. And it's run entirely on a not-for-profit basis. So their support is absolutely crucial. And thank you to you folk. Please pass along my thanks to your team as well. Jason Tetro was the man who organized everything today. Jason's over in the corner here. Thank you very much, Jason. You did a fabulous job. I appreciate that. And if you don't know Jason locally, he's the German guy on radio. And lastly, I'd like to thank all of our teleclass audiences. I think everyone in the room here today has probably joined at least one teleclass. So thank you. And to those of you who are listening by teleclass, thank you for joining us today and for supporting the program always. On the very last slide of your PowerPoints, there are a few of the teleclasses that are coming up, some of them sponsored by the World Health Organization, who also has been a great supporter of teleclass education. So please plan to join those, and we'll talk to you again very soon. Goodbye.